So, we have some time to spend with Mitra Vadri. Okay, so, you know, we've already, Biocity welcomed her earlier. Mitra Vadri, you know, an important, significant and central figure at the London Buddhist Centre and has been for a number of years. But I'm going to ask you questions. We can have a conversation about about things. But first, just the standard first question, your name, Mitra Vadri, just to give a bit of background here. So what would you say Mitra Vadri meant? What was the meaning for you of your name?
It's a good question, isn't it? Because when one's given the name, it's like being given a teaching. Yeah, so it's sort of something to carry. Well, I think it's something for us to carry with ourselves. Because in a way, it sort of symbolises a qualities or a way of orientating oneself in the world that would lead to enlightenment if it was perfected. So for that reason, it tends to change over time, I think. I don't know how you find it, but the sort of the weight I give to it or the way I look at it changes. So literally, Maitri is the same as metta. It's a Sanskrit word for metta, so that's the universal loving kindness. And Vadri is the feminine form of Vajra, or the diamond thunderbolt. So that's a symbol of a particular kind of energy. So it's sort of used to describe a sort of like a koan of when an unstoppable energy meets an immovable object. But it's really a sort of also a symbol for ultimate reality, you know, for awakening itself. So when I was given it, one of the more public meanings was that I was a diamond or mite of universal love and kindness or friendliness, which I always feel like was, it's partly my cultural conditioning. You know, I'm a New Zealander and I come from a culture that is pretty communally community orientated, so I always feel like I was riding the back of a cultural momentum there. But I think as the years have gone on, I see it more and more that I'm somebody who has to love my way to awakening. So somehow learning to sort of turn towards whatever, you know, whether it's pleasant or painful or neutral or difficult or easy, and just love what's ever there, you know. So I suppose I sort of see it quite directly these days as a kind of path, actually, a sort of that keeps reminding me to engage positively.
You've just said that you're a New Zealander. Everyone knew that, or guessed if they didn't know before. When did you come to this country?
I came in summer of 89, so what does that mean? That means it was June or July, I can never remember which month. So what does that mean? I've been here 26, 27 years, nearly, 27 years? 28?
Yeah.
Goodness me. It was. I was only supposed to come for 2 years, you see, that was the plan, but never mind.
When were you ordained? When did you get the name?
I got ordained in 1997. Yep. So I'll be 20 on the solstice this year.
Right, So in your upbringing in New Zealand, actually it would be fascinating to talk here lots about that, but we probably haven't got enough time for everything. But looking back, could you sort of identify anything about your early upbringing or your conditioning or, you know, who you were, if you like, who you found yourself to be as a child, that would at the time maybe give some clues as to how you ended up, you know, being ordained as a Buddhist?
Okay.
You just talked about your name as that path of love. Is there some continuity from your kind of early experience or any particular events that connect with it? Or not, maybe.
Well, it's a bit... I mean, I was brought up in a Protestant household, and I was brought up in a household where my dad, when he was in his 30s, gave up being an architect and trained to become a Presbyterian minister. So, but it was also a very complex family. It was a dysfunctional family. So I was brought up in a family that had particularly my dad, but my parents had quite a public face, and the private was quite ugly, actually, and mixed. So I think for me, by the time I was in my teens, I didn't want to have anything to do with any kind of organised religion whatsoever. So I always think it's a bit odd that I've turned out to be a religious zealot, really. but I think there's something that sticks... Well, there's a few things that stick out from my childhood, you know, those really kind of extraordinary things, isn't it? So one of them is that I was a very avid reader as a child, a very, very avid reader. And because I started stealing books from school, my parents, at about the age of 5 or 6, my parents thought we'd better enrol her in the public library, you know, before we breed a criminal of a particular sort. And so on Friday evenings, we would go down to the Rotorua Public Library, and there was a great children's book section there, and you were allowed to get 3 books out, which I'd normally read by about 6 o'clock Saturday morning, because I used to frequently go to the toilet and turn the hall light on and then come back and read by the hall light coming through my bedroom. But they had this fantastic series of books, and it was called The Myths and Legends Of. So there would be like The Myths and Legends of India, or The Myths and Legends of Persia, it was in those days, or The Myths and Legends of England, or whatever. They had this sort of, they went round the world, and I read all of those books. And I think then, despite being brought up a Protestant, which is quite... you know, there's an absence, isn't there, of sort of, well, certainly in my Protestant upbringing, there was a real absence of sort of ritual or myth or anything like that. That fed something very deep in me, I think. That's always loved ritual and connected with ritual. So I think it's a combination of that, and I was very, very fortunate, I think, being brought up in New Zealand. So I was... my early childhood was spent in a city called Rotorua, in the middle of the North Island, which is quite a seat for Māori sovereignty. And so I grew up in an area where there were local gods, where there were sacred lakes, where certain things were tapu, which was, you know, they're sacred, and if as a Pākehā, as a white person, you disturb that, then difficult things would befall you, and things did happen, and I was just brought up and that was all natural. So I feel a lot of gratitude for having grown up in a country where an Indigenous people still had a very live relationship with other beings and with the landscape, and that I was able to sort of absorb that. So I think those sorts of influences really fed this less rational, the sort of the non-rational, you know, the archetypal sort of aspect of my character, which my family didn't feed, you know. So, yes, I feel very grateful to all of that. And it was a mythic landscape, you know, there's boiling mud pools, there's hot water geysers, there's sacred mountains, you know. So it's, I think the landscape's very sort of mythic in New Zealand. Yes, I feel grateful. I feel very grateful for having been born and raised here. I think I was very fortunate.
So maybe making a bit of a jump from to architecture, because assume that was an interest. Well, you mentioned something there. We just heard that your father at one point was an architect, maybe there's a link there. Yeah. But at some point you became interested in architecture. Yeah. Actually, how did that fit? When did that happen? And how did it happen, and how did that maybe fit into this mythic imagination that has been sort of sparked off in you?
Yeah. I mean, I can remember it was at least by the age of 8 I wanted to be an architect, probably earlier. I think. I think when I did get to architecture school, which was very unusual for women to do architecture in my time, it's still not hugely common for women in this country or New Zealand, but was even less so then. I remember once we did an impromptu survey, and every woman at architecture school when I was there had a parent who was an architect or a builder. So there was something about having to have contact with that world, you know. But I can remember drawing, you know, drawing buildings and cutting plans of buildings out of magazines and things like that when I was very young. And my dad, he bought this piece of land in Rotorua, and he built a house modelled on Frank Lloyd Wright's houses. He was a big fan of Frank Lloyd Wright. And it was one of those houses that people used to drive by and have a look at, and us kids would, without my father knowing, of course, would stand outside and poke faces at people that did that. So, but I think that had a big influence on me, just this, the lounge in particular was this long room with cork tiles that were polished and windows, probably a similar proportion to Pedrasna's windows, but not quite down to the ground. And, you know, there was a lot, my dad had designed the furniture in that room too. So there was something about that room, I think, for me, it always held, it held beauty. I think that was the thing, that was my connection with beauty, was through the natural world in New Zealand, but also through architecture. Yeah, so I think those were the two sort of main avenues for beauty for me.
So you studied architecture in New Zealand first?
Well, actually, I did a Bachelor of Arts first in sociology, and then I had a car accident, actually. I was hit by a hit-and-run driver, and I was was hospitalised with a clot in my leg, and I think I was 20. I think I was 20 when that happened. And I remember this consultant coming around and saying to me, I was a smoker in those days, and he said to me, if you continue to smoke at the rate you're smoking now, you've got a, I can't remember what the percentage was, but quite a high percentage chance that I would be back there when I was in my 40s and going out in a box, I think is how he put it. He was obviously trying to frighten me into changing my habits, which didn't happen for another 10 years. But I do remember not being able to sleep all one night and thinking, oh, if I was to die, what would I regret? And I thought, oh, I would have regretted not having applied to do architecture. So I just thought, okay, I'll apply to do architecture. It was not that long before my final exams for the Bachelor of Arts. And then I'll give it a year and just see. And then at least I won't be thinking in my 40s when I'm back here with another clot on my leg because I smoke too much. I won't be thinking, I wish I'd done that. Mm. So that's quite significant, that particular car accident, I think, in terms of, I suppose there's something in there about mortality and decision-making, isn't there? Mm. Yeah. So that's when I decided I'd go to architecture school.
Okay. Yeah. So was it the architecture or work or study that brought you to England?
Oh, it was the architecture.
Yeah.
Worldly ambition.
Worldly ambition.
Nothing spiritual whatsoever, really. So when I left architecture school, there was a huge recession in the October, just before we sat our final exams in the November. And I think I was one of only six people in my graduating class who managed to get work that year. I also had been in a relationship with a very lovely man called Julian, who I'm still friends with, from the age of 20 to the age of 30. And that relationship had just ended. And so suddenly, a lot of my friends were sort of more into the settling down process of their life, and I was unsettling. And there was a whole crowd of us that were away somewhere. I can't remember what time of the year it was, but anyway, there was a whole gang of us away. And somebody found an ad for architects being wanted here in this country. And they said, oh, you could apply to do that. So that was another one where I didn't sleep all night, and I'm just thinking, oh, what might I regret? And I thought, well, I could give it a go, couldn't I? I could come over here and give it a go. And the what I really, really wanted to do was come here and work for a couple of years, learn French, and I really fancied being a Parisian architect. but I met what was then the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. I re-engaged with them. I had made contact with them in New Zealand. So I thought, oh, well, why not try? So I went for one of these jobs because there were people recruiting. You know, people from England were going out and recruiting in New Zealand because there was such a building boom over here. The joke was if you knew how to hold a pencil, you'd get a job, you know. And luckily the guy was really lovely who interviewed me. He was a New Zealander. His firm had sent him out. So he had a look at my portfolio and stuff and said, look, you'll have no trouble getting a job. If you go over under your own steam, you'll earn twice as much as what my firm will give you. So I thought, oh, well, I'll do that then. So I bought a one-way ticket and I had two suitcases and I had £200. And I had an aunt and uncle who very kindly put me up for the first few months. And I remember I had 6 job interviews in 2 weeks. And then I chose the job I dreamt about. I had this very lovely dream about one of the jobs. So I thought, oh, that's the building I'll work on. So, yeah.
Well, one-way ticket.
Yeah.
There's a certain sort of something in that, isn't there?
One-way ticket. Youth. Youth. This was... Yeah, it was really nice, actually. It was very, very lovely. I had my grandfather's sister had died, and I'd never met her, and she left me £100. So I collected this £100 when I got here. Yeah.
What part of the country were you living in?
When I first came here. I've always lived in London. Always, yeah.
Right. So, well, you mentioned there you had made contact with FWBO, tree, right, or as we call it now in New Zealand.
Yeah.
And then was that something you followed up immediately when you came to?
No.
What
so
was that just a, you know, a little thing?
It was, I learned to meditate in New Zealand. Well, I don't know if learning to meditate is quite the right way of putting it. Basically, in the back of a ute sort of thing going to my first retreat, someone said, oh, you do the mindfulness of breathing like this. You sort of breathe in, you breathe out, and you count. I think that was about my meditation instruction, really. Mm-hmm. And so I practiced with the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order for about 2 years. I meditated every day. I did puja once a week. I did not call myself a Buddhist. I was not going to bow down to the Buddha. You know, even if he was a Buddha, he was a man. I was not going to bow down to him. And then there was something not quite fitting right with me. And what happened was I got very involved with a group of women who did a lot of feminist ritual. So they were working a lot with very positive female archetypes. And I was involved in that work, and it was very, very important for me for about 3 years. And during that period, came to London. But I continued to meditate, and I started to have real trouble with my meditation practice. I kept feeling like I was going to be ill when I was meditating. And one day I got time out at work, and I just noticed there was a course in Covent Garden. So I thought, well, I've never done a meditation course. Maybe that would help. So I signed up for the 6-week meditation course. And I was really fortunate because one of the people leading that course was Dharma Dinner. And she's not only a very, very good teacher, but she had lived in New Zealand for a couple of years. And I remember her saying to me, oh, I left a piece of my heart in New Zealand. And I think I just thought, oh, I can... You know, I can trust this woman. You know, there was some kind of connection there because of it. And I remember asking, I forget the man's name who was leading that course with Dharma Dinner, and I was explaining to him that when I was meditating, I kept getting this experience like I was going to vomit, you know. And I was absolutely convinced that he was going to say to me, you just have to push through. And he went, oh, "Oh, I'd stop if I were you." And, I mean, oh, really, really. And I think that's the first glimmer I had of my own willfulness, you know, sort of my over effort was what was causing it. But it was such a lovely thing to say, really. Oh, I'd stop. So, yeah. So then, you know, I started going on retreat. I started going to the London Buddhist Centre, and I basically never left, you know. I never got to Paris. Well, I have gotten to Paris, but not to live.
So we're having to jump a bit here, but there's some interesting themes here. That some, so you were working as an architect, but then as you got more involved at the London Buddhist Centre, and maybe was it post-ordination in a way you gave up?
That was before being a full, I was ordained.
It was before you were ordained. You stopped being a, you know, a full-time professional architect.
So I used to practice architecture and also teach architectural design. And then the London Buddhist Arts Centre came into being. Srivati was sort of heading up that project with Chintamani. And I think some people like Sangadevi and Malika had a bit of a chat and thought it would be good if I did that. So I was thinking, I mean, it seems a bit mad now, doesn't it? I gave up a very, very good job to go and work voluntarily at this London Buddhist Arts Centre. But I also had another health scare. So I had a... I'd gone to New Zealand and I got very ill. I was supposed to just go for a couple of months. I ended up there for 5 months. And I had a large growth removed from my womb. And had it been malignant, I really would have been in trouble, you know. But that was another one of those sort of, oh my goodness, you know, life's quite fragile and it's impermanent. Well, we all know it's impermanent, but it was quite live. So I think that fueled that sort of letting go. Plus, I'd worked on this really, really lovely building, actually. It was a large bank and office development down in St Mary's Axe, near the Baltic Exchange, for those of you that know London. And 2 weeks before it was to be opened, it was a £40 million development, the IRA blew it up. And I'd worked like there was no tomorrow on that project. I worked on average 70 hours a week for about 18 months on that project. And I think something in me kind of broke, which was probably, if I look back now, would be about having that kind of intense involvement in a project as a false refuge. I think that's what it would be. I didn't know to call it that. But when I read the story about Milarepa's Towers, you know, when Marpa, the teacher of Milarepa, gets Milarepa to build these towers and then destroy them and build them again, it struck a chord with me, something there about seeing the insubstantiality of something. So I think that also fueled a willingness to loosen around what was a very vocational career for me. It wasn't just a love. I lived for it, absolutely lived for it.
So that was that space, if you like, filled by you working and being much more involved at the London Buddhist Centre. There was the Art Centre as well and the Buddhist Centre.
Well, I think it was a bit more rocky than that, really. So just trying to think of all. So I left my career and I was working part-time at the Art Centre. I was recovering from the operation. I was in the ordination process and I went to work at an architect's office as an administrator. I was their filing clerk, actually. And it was a very, very good, it was a very, very good firm. So that felt quite positive because I felt like I was still supporting the creation of really beautiful spaces. And I think I did a lot of work on myself. You know, I really did a lot of inner work in that time and a lot of work on my history. And I was preparing for ordination and I was giving as much time as I could to the London Buddhist Centre and supporting, you know, supporting classes and courses and retreats and things there. And then I was ordained, you know, as part of that process. And then after ordination, I knew that I wanted to work with the bereaved and the dying. I had this real sense of that. So I did a lot of small courses. I did study groups with Rigpa, you know, who ran very good courses on the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. And then I eventually found a bereavement counselling course. It was the only one in the country at the time, and I retrained as a bereavement counsellor. So then I sort of worked for myself and did, I worked for mental health organisations. I did MBCT courses and I did bereavement courses, and I also ran and did bereavement counselling and bereavement groups. But I also did things at the Buddhist Centre, like use a course on bereavement as an insight practice, and just sort of, I suppose it's interesting, isn't it, it's that whole theme again of the fragility of a human life and what that sort of shakes up in you, I suppose. Yeah. And then my dad died, actually. My dad died. And I think about a year or so later, I went to work at the London Buddhist Centre full time. So that was in early 2008, I did that.
Yeah. I mean, I know that you've done a lot of work, particularly, you know, in more recent years at the London Buddhist Centre with organising and caring for the whole army, almost, a team of volunteers there, for instance, and you're a member of the, with me, of the council and a trustee of the London Buddhist Centre. And you've done a lot of teaching and a lot of providing, you know, spiritual friendship to women there. So there's so much we could explore in that, but in a way I'm going to jump again a little bit, because in a way there was your past career, if you like, and I know that you did actually do some architectural work for the LBC in the meantime. But mainly there'd been your professional career, and then this total involvement in the London Buddhist Centre, and then suddenly in, I forget, 5 years ago or something.
It was seven, the first.
Was it seven?
Our first meeting was 7 years ago,
It was seven years ago. And then suddenly it seems to me, looking on, that those two aspects of your life, you know, which in a way had been a bit sort of separate and maybe slightly overlapping, but... seemed there was an opportunity for them to really come together, which is when we started planning the changes at Padrasana. Did it feel like that? You know?
Yeah, because I think what happened was I felt like, to a large extent, I let go of my career, and I was very willing to do it, but, you know, I had really loved it. And then I immersed myself in something else. And then this opportunity arose, which we didn't know what the opportunity was till we were quite a way into it. So I remember we had this, it was on one of our trustees' retreats. We do them every year. And we were at the old Vidrasana. And we were busy having this conversation about raising the money to extend the kitchen and the dining room, wasn't it?
That's right.
And we were absolutely terrified that health and safety, if they ever visited, would close us down if they saw the state of the kitchen.
They didn't, by the way.
Yeah.
They did visit and they didn't close us
But then I think what happened then, I can remember then thinking and talking about, oh, it would be good if we had a plan for the redevelopment of the whole site, even if we were doing it bit by bit. And then, of course, very sadly for us, Mahananda died, you know, who was a really, really loved member of our Sangha. Really special man, wasn't he? He was a really big, big-hearted man. But he left us a very substantial legacy. So suddenly it was kind of like, oh, we could imagine really big. And I think then that's where my background was helpful, because I was completely convinced of the value of scrapping it all and starting again. And I was utterly confident that if we got the right architectural firm, there'd be a firm out there of highly creative people who would pour themselves into that project for the love of its uniqueness.
right.
and the creativity,
yeah.
because that's the sort of architect I'd been, and that's the sort of architects and architecture I'd been involved with. So I just knew it was a... I was very, very confident about that, you know. So, and that's in the end what we did, wasn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Yeah. So we, I mean, Mitre have had, well, we, the trustees meeting, there's 12 of us or so,
mm-hmm.
you know, we formed a subcommittee.
But the Drasna subcommittee,
the
so
Drasna
poetic,
subcommittee.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
So poetic, yeah.
yeah. Of five of us?
Yeah, five.
Yeah, five of us, yeah.
yeah.
And, you know, you with your experience,
mm.
and, you know, it wasn't, you said just then, it was useful. It wasn't just useful, it was absolutely vital. We'd have never have got anywhere near what we have, I think,
mm.
without your experience, you know, from your from our side, that gave our side this experience. Anyway, you with your experience were really able to kind of lead us and guide us in that, I think. And then we set about choosing an architect to do the project, didn't we?
So I can remember Baya Bhadra and I, I don't know if you remember this, Abhaya Bhadra. We went up to the arts centre in that big room.
Oh,
I don't know if you've ever been.
Yeah.
And we had measuring tapes, and we were
working
out how big a one-bedroom, a one-bed bedroom should be, and how big a two-bed bedroom should be. And we were measuring it all out, and how many we should have. So we developed this very sort of prosaic brief, which was, you know, we want a kitchen for this many people, and a dining room for this many people, and this many bedrooms, and what the sizes and stuff were. And then we had this completely poetic brief, didn't we, which was all about beauty and how we wanted people to go on a journey throughout the retreat centre, and how we wanted them to come at the end of that journey to a shrine room, and that was to be the jewel, you know, the jewel of it. And we didn't want that to be explicit from the onset. We wanted hints of it, but we wanted there to be a sort of path. Well, it was quite mythic in itself, wasn't it? That you went on this journey and then you arrived somewhere really special. And the architects have said publicly since it's very unusual for a client to sort of put in a brief that they value beauty, you know. So that, I think that really appealed to them. And then what we did was... I rang up the RIBA client advisory service and spoke to this really lovely guy there and said to him, this is our project, do you think you can help us find someone? So he came up with four firms, and we put the word out in our community, the London Buddhist Centre Sangha, and people in our Sangha recommended five other architectural firms. And then we got together, and we got it down to four quite quickly. Some were too big. Two of them were just too big. You know, they were too international. We thought we're not going to get the intimate attention that we would so demand. And, well, I would. And others were too small. You know, it would just be too big, too large a project. So that turned out to be two architectural firms that came from the RIBA Client Advisory Service and two from within our own community. And we approached all of those and asked if they wanted to come for an interview and to share first thoughts and things. And three of them moved forward with that, which one, of course, were Walters and Cohen.
And it was fairly obvious that they were the ones who really caught something of what we were wanting, really, I think, didn't they?
I can remember the first ever phone call I had with them. First of all, someone from their office rang up and just said, look, there's two principals in that firm, Michelle and Cindy, Michelle Cohen and Cindy Walters, and they were away at the Venice Biennale, and so they were away for a long weekend. And she said, we've just opened up, you know, your mail, and I know they'll be very, very interested, and they'll get back to you as soon as they're back. And Cindy rang me up, and now that I know her well, I know it's quite unusual for her to say this, but we were chatting on the phone, and she said, oh, it's really funny, Mike, we've had you. When I was in Venice with Michelle, I said to her, remember that Buddhist retreat we went on in South Africa? She said, we must get back there. We must get back there and do something like that. And then she said, and I came back and there was your, you know, package inviting. So she said it was meant to be. And then she went, oh, no, 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 I should never have said that. You know, and I went, oh, no, it's absolutely fine to say that. And her and, I'm trying to think of the woman who was involved right at the beginning.
Jean
Wang, yeah. They came to the London Buddhist Centre. They came to a lunchtime meditation class, and then they spent the whole of the afternoon just looking at the businesses around the whole sort of community we have around the London Buddhist Centre, but just also asking really insightful questions. And I can remember being in the shrine room in the basement at the Buddhist Centre, and somebody turning to me and saying, what kind of architectural form do you think best suits your way of practicing? And I thought, oh, that's just the best question ever. Because for me, that all goes back to Bhante Sangharakshita's book, you know, The Religion of Art, where he's looking at art as a way of expressing things of value. And she was sort of asking those sorts of questions, you know. And, of course, we don't have a form within our community. We mainly adapt, don't we, other buildings. So we were able to start talking about that this was largely a building without precedents, actually. It's never been done before. And they were so up for the creative challenge of that. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. So that was the start of...
That was the start of that process.
5 years, I suppose,
yeah.
Then, wasn't it?
Yeah,
appointing them.
Yeah.
I think everyone either knows Vajrasana or... have you been to the... Yeah, that's right. It was the older...
Yeah.
Oh, right. No. Well, you must. And I'm sure you will. So, okay. There's an aspect of it that I'd like to try and dig out, if you like, and explore with you. Not so much about the building itself, but about, for you, that whole process, because it's been 5 years of really intense work, isn't it?
Yeah.
Probably in the sense for all of us involved, but particularly for yourself.
Mm.
And I think, you know, we've all been pushed to have to make decisions that, you know, involving lots of money, for instance, you know, making decisions at a level which I'm not used to, and most of us probably aren't. And my experience is of having to learn a lot about myself in the process. Mm. Of course, I myself was living there, so... For me, it was more like this personal upheaval of moving out, and then the whole place was flattened, well, apart from the house, and then moving back and being involved in all the changes. But I know for you, it seems that it used almost every bit of you up, if you like. Not used you up, but it needed all of you to be
engaged.
Really fully engaged in it, yeah.
Yeah.
So, with the time we got left, I just wanted to sort of, what have you had to learn? What lessons did it call on you to learn? Maybe spiritual or otherwise. How do you think it's been? I know it hasn't finished yet, at least not for another couple of weeks, in a way.
And then,
how has it changed you personally, being involved in that project?
It's made something whole in me, actually, and because I'm quite a multifaceted person, which is also one way of saying I had a lot to integrate, and I think that's all sort of quite, it feels like it's all come together in a way that gives me a very deep confidence in the Dharma, actually, in serving the Dharma. But I was just sort of thinking, like, there was all the aspect of working with people, whether it was us five working out how to work together and all everything that we went through. Then there was a whole other aspect, which was about communicating to our community and trying to communicate our decisions and processes and involve people and be available for questions and meeting people about that. Then there was all the... I mean, that's one of the things I loved about architecture, was that you get together with this team of professional people. You know, there's builders, and there's, you know, all the tradespeople, there's engineers, you know, there's designers, and you create something. I've always loved that. I love being on site. I love that, the earthiness of it all coming out of the ground. So that was all in there. And then also there was a whole layer of rituals that I did. So I think that all got sort of really built in. So I did lots of rituals. Remember we did stuff, didn't we, before to close it down. I remember you and I doing stuff one day there. And then there were those, that crystal vajra that ended down at the LBC. We had a crystal vajra on the shrine at Vajrasana, the old Vajrasana, for since the summer, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So for about 6 months. And then we took that to there, and that was to sort of absorb all the energy of the shrine room there. And then we took that down to the LBC and ritually placed it on the shrine at the LBC. And it stayed there until just before the foundations were laid in the shrine room. And then it was buried underneath where the Buddha now sits. And, well, I could tell you, there's quite a few things buried in the stupa, for instance. Yeah. And there's various rituals that went on around the site. And some of those rituals I just had to do while the building was going on.
Yeah.
And it just got to the stage where there wasn't any part of my life that was private in a positive way. It just all kind of flowed. Everything got to be visible in a way, I think.
Yeah, I've got an image of, you know, you, I don't know if that was a crystal vajra or not, you know, putting something in the hole that had been dug by the JCB driver.
That was the double vajra for the stupa.
It was the double for the stupa, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, the man with his big machinery had dug the hole and you put the vajra in and then you were circumambulating, chanting with all the builders watching on.
They helped me bury it and stuff. They all sort of spontaneously joined in, and I wasn't there at one point. I couldn't be there one day when we had to, there were certain things I wanted to put into the foundations of the stupa. So I had a Buddha figure, a terracotta Buddha figure, that had been cast when the LBC was first built. And I had a green tara that Vasantra and Vijayamala had given me that they'd had on their 3-year solitary retreat. And they got put in the concrete mixer, and then there in the foundations of the stupa.
No.
Yeah. And I remember I had to ask one of the builders to do that for me. And then I said to Mum, can I ask you to do something for me while you're doing it? He goes, oh, okay. And I said, could you make a wish? Could you make a wish that it would be helpful to all beings? And he said, yep, I can do that for you. some of those builders really need to play poker. They just, but they were so good to us. They were so good to us. And I remember as I was leaving the site hut, you know, as I was going out the door, he went, Maitri Vajri. He went, I'll do that wish. Don't you forget. I won't forget. Don't you worry. So I felt like there was so much well-wishing from so many people. That place was built with love, you know, and I had some very, very interesting conversations with builders on site about the Buddha or about the architecture and, you know, or I can remember one guy said to me, he was talking to me about his daughter and he said, oh, she's so spiritual, you know. And it was so lovely to hear a man talk about his daughter. She was 19 in that way. It was very, very moving. So I think a lot of love went into that place, actually, you know. At every level, we were very, very fortunate.
Just checking the time. We're going to have to finish in a minute.
Yeah.
So the project, in a way, is... Vajrasana has been open for a year, obviously, and in a way the final handing over is supposed, at least technically, to happen in a couple of weeks' time, isn't it? How does the future look to you now? Are you in the process of letting go of it?
Well, I think I always have.
Yeah.
That's the funny thing. So from quite early on, I used to have these very strong feelings which have never really left me, which is, it's it was like it's already done, it's already lived, and it's already been a ruin. It's like it's there's something for me, like I've been incredibly wholehearted about it. I honestly don't think I could have been more wholehearted. But it's never been mine, and it's always been... there's a Zen thing. There's a Zen master that once said, I look at this glass, and, you know, he's looking at a glass of water, he's holding a glass of water, and he says, I look at this glass, and it's already broken. And for me, there's been, at a very deep level, there's always been that about the Drasna. It's like it's never been ours, it's never been mine. But it's been an offering. And I think a lot of conditions came together, a lot of people and conditions came together for it to be built. And I can remember, you know, the first retreat, which was straight after the opening, and I couldn't sleep one night, and I was just walking around in my nightgown in the middle of the night. I just couldn't bear to be inside anymore. And it just felt like all this energy was coming out of the ground. It was just pouring out of the ground, and it was pouring down from the sky. And I thought, oh, all our collective efforts have just been the key in a door. And the door's open. But it's kind of, it's not like we weren't part of it, but it's also in a funny kind of way, nothing to do with us because it's so much bigger than us, and yet we were important for it to happen. Mm. I don't know how to... So for me, there's always been a thing about being wholehearted, but it's never, never been mine. But I suppose the thing for me is just part of creating anything is one just has to be in the unknown. And I think that's probably one of the things we've really learned to do with this project. You never know when something's not going to go right. You don't know when there's going to be a difficulty. You don't know who you're going to have to communicate to about what. You're always sort of doing something you've never done before. And I suppose I'm just more and more aware of stepping into more of that unknown. I think the thing that's hardest for me to let go of, in a way, is just being active. You know, more than that actual project. Yeah. It's just I love to do, and I'm going to need a period of not doing. And that'll be really interesting to be coming down from that into something more quiet and still, I think.
Mm. I'm sure that will take you into something else. Equally worthwhile and deep, you know. It's like that one-way ticket, in a way. Yeah. There's no returns in life. And you seem to sort of bought your one-way ticket that's taken you.
It's a nice way of looking at it, isn't it?
And an offering as well.
I think that, for me, I think one of my myths is, if you like, is to be with a group of people... Sorry, I'm going to cry. Creating something for making the Dharma available, you know, for beauty and just for the freedom that the Dharma offers. I think that's the main way I relate to the Dharma, is that it's a path to freedom. And I think, oh, how fortunate in this life that I got to be with people like yourself, and we got to do this. Even though at times I think we didn't know whether we'd physically make it to the end or not, you know. But I just think, how many people have that kind of good fortune in their lives? I feel very, very fortunate, very blessed, really blessed.
Well, thank you. So we're going to end it there. I don't think I can say any more than that. But I say thank you. Thank you for your life at the LBC, and in particular your inspiration. And I said, actually, in a little email I sent around, just to let people know that, you know, we've got this evening, that, what did I say? It was just off the cuff, really. I said, you've been the heartbeat and the, what did I say? The heartbeat and the driving force of the Vajrasana project. So we wouldn't have what we have without you there. So thank you for that. Thank you very much for coming and just being so open about yourself. And I'm just ashamed we've had so little time, really. So much more we could have explored. Thank you for what you're giving.
Thank you. Thank you.